So we're going to get underway. You know, leading up to this conference, I had a number of people ask me, you know, what are you most excited about as it pertains to this year's agenda? And this is it right here. We have the honor of having in our presence Professor Gene Fama. Gene was the 2013 Nobel Laureate in Economic Sciences and is widely recognized as the father of modern finance. The research that he's done is really well known in both the academic and here in the broader investment community. He's strongly identified with research on markets and in particular the efficient markets hypothesis. Much of his research focuses on the relationship between risk and expected returns and its implications for portfolio management. And honestly, his work has transformed the way finance is viewed, conducted. I don't think we'd have a room of 700 people here talking ETFs, passive investing more broadly, if it hadn't been for a lot of the work that Gene has done over the years. Additionally, Gene is a father of four, a grandfather of 10, an avid windsurfer, golfer, opera buff, and a faded tennis player. Did you put faded in your own bio? Mm-hmm.
Faded is too mild at this point.
And last but certainly not least, a member of the Malden Catholic High School Hall of Fame. So Gene, thank you for being here. Athletic Hall of Fame, sorry. So the first question I want to ask you, given that you've been looking at the markets for so long and again, the father of the efficient markets hypothesis, how has your understanding of market efficiency evolved over the course of the past few decades?
Oh, it's such a simple concept. There hasn't been much evolution. There's been a ton of empirical testing. That's the hard part. That's always been the hard part. Basically, that's what I pointed out early on. Everybody knew what they meant by an efficient market, but the problem was, how do you test it? And that's where I got my feet in the water.
So how is the way that you've been able to test that hypothesis evolved over time?
Ah, well, we go back to the beginning. You're talking 1960, 63. First computers came around. It released all these econometricians from their mechanical calculators. Most of you have probably never even seen one. But released them from doing those things. In those days, you had to have two research assistants doing exactly the same thing to make sure they came up with the same answer and hope they didn't collude. Because the probability that somebody would make a mistake was very high. So the computers liberated people, and the data that are most easily available, of course, are stock prices. So immediately people started studying the behavior of stock prices, and economists being involved, they said, well, how would we expect prices to behave if markets were operating properly? And that's where the efficient markets hypothesis came from.
Now, what we're seeing over time, and I think why a lot of us are here, is that we're seeing investors at large around the world pouring more and more money into index funds, into ETFs, into
finally.
Just barely. It's all paying off.
Yeah.
But as this happens, is the market potentially becoming maybe more or less efficient?
Well, there's this fallacy that people have that says you need active managers to make the market efficient. That's true to some extent, but only if they're informed active managers, because bad active managers make the market less efficient. So I'm preaching to the converted here, so I wish you had more active managers in the room, because I would enjoy that a lot more. I point out there is an arithmetic. Bill Sharpe wrote this paper 20-some-odd years ago called The Arithmetic of Active Management, where he basically pointed out that passive managers are out of the game because they basically hold cap-weighted portfolios, and they don't respond to active managers. So if active managers win, it has to be at the expense of other active managers. And when you add them all up, the returns to active managements have to be literally zero before cost. And then after cost, the big negative sum, some game. So the question is like, when is active management good? The answer is never. Because it's always a zero-sum game. It's not, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. And that's a really difficult perspective to get people to accept.
But is there a theoretical limit to all of this in that, as you described?
Yeah, theoretically, Ken French and I have a paper that says, theoretically, you need one investor with a tiny amount of wealth who's informed about everything and will not trade until prices are correct. That's enough to make the market efficient.
So that's what we have in the future.
That's the active manager.
Really smart active manager.
Right, with a tiny amount of wealth. But so that's mathematics. It's not really practical stuff.
based on, you know, the simple arithmetic Bill Sharpe laid out in his paper, based on, you know, market efficiency, if markets are efficient, if the evidence shows us all of this, why do you think investors continue to allocate so much money to high fee managers or to more exotic active strategies?
I don't know. I don't know, really. As far as individual investors are concerned, they're clearly so much better off buying passive products than they are buying active products that it's really laughable. And so we can move on to professional, a pension fund manager. Is he more likely to be able to tell good from bad active managers? Well, Ken French and I did a paper, and we said, let's take all of the mutual fund. We're at a Morningstar conference, after all. Let's take all of the mutual fund data. Let's look at all of the funds that have existed where we have good data on the ones that actually died. We asked, what would the distribution of outcomes look like over the entire lifetimes of these funds if there was no ability to pick stocks? And you'd be shocked at the range of outcomes that you can get purely by chance. And what you actually see is, if you take their costs, if you look at what investors get, they look awful. Then it looks like there are 3% of the funds that have about enough information to cover their costs. The top 3%. Now these are, I laugh at things that are really painful. These are the funds, the top 3% would be funds that did 3% plus, you know, alpha 3% plus over their entire lifetimes. So these are people that books would be written about. But on a going forward basis, they're about as good as you'd expect the top 3% to be if they had just enough information to cover their costs, which means that going forward, you expect them to look like an index fund in terms of their alpha. So it's kind of discouraging. But the really discouraging part, it's all discouraging. If you take the portfolio of active mutual funds and combine it cap-weighted, what do you get? The market portfolio. You aggregate them, they're holding the market. And investors are paying them 1% to hold the market, basically. You can get that for a couple of basis points if you go to a passive vehicle. So your question, I don't know the answer to. I mean, what is the penetration now? I know when Ken did his AFA presidential speech, in the mutual fund industry, only 20% was passively managed at that point. So I don't know what it is now.
Yeah, 20-30%.
Is it still that low?
Yeah.
Okay, well,
so you figure starting from a base of zero, right, let's call it 40 years ago.
You can understand incentives on the other side, right?
Yeah.
More fees are better than less. But you can't understand it so much from the investor side.
So if more fees becomes less fees and active managers, you know, charge less for their services, is there any hope there, or is it still a hopeless case?
If you can identify the good ones, but the problem is, in the distribution, the good ones might be good or they might be lucky. Mm-hmm. The bad ones might be bad or they might be unlucky, and you don't really, you can't really tell the difference. I don't know that it would ever make sense to. Even if their fees was zero, of course the passive fees would go to zero. I don't think you'd be better off because you'd be investing in an undiversified way. So if you buy a lot of them to get diversification, okay. That's a maybe an entertaining way to buy the market portfolio, but why not just buy it?
I'm curious to know in either investors' sort of fund selection behavior or just in the behavior of just securities prices more generally, what role do you see in investor behavior playing? Do you buy into behavioral arguments at all?
Well, you know, economics is all about behavior. So no economist says behavior is irrelevant. Behavior is what generates everything that goes on in economics. So the issue is rational versus irrational behavior. So there is behavioral finance, which is all about irrational. Behavioral economics, really just cognitive psychology. It's all about irrational behavior. And what they do is they study people in very restricted environments, typically students, in some kind of a game that they're playing. And you see manifestations of irrational behavior, definitely at the micro level. On a cost basis, it doesn't pay to be completely rational with respect to small decisions. It pays more to be rational as decisions get more important. But in any case, what's happened is that there are two kinds of people who do behavioral finance. One is real behaviorists, like my colleague Richard Thaler, who kind of invented this area. And the others are people who just kind of dredge for anomalies. They're looking out there for things that can't be explained by existing risk-return models. And when they find them, they say that's a victory for behavioral finance. But if it has no roots in something that comes out of behavioral science, it really has nothing to do with behavioral finance. So as far as how successful have they been at describing market prices, that I do not get. I don't see that they've had much luck there.
So I want to switch gears a bit and talk about the concept of risk. I think risk has been a very important topic in the past 5+ years.
Right.
And there's just this ongoing debate as to, you know, how do you define and measure risk? How do you think about risk in an investment setting?
Well, that's a complicated question. The first order thing is just volatility of your total portfolio. Not the pieces, but the total portfolio put together. Every asset pricing model says that's relevant. Now, then you get these multi-factor asset pricing models that Bob Merton wrote the initial theoretical paper on this in 1973, which says that, well, there can be different dimensions of risk that have different prices per unit of risk. And that's when you get into the more, you know, murky area, but the multi-dimensional risk area where you have different risk premiums for different sources of risk. So, for example, the Fama-French three-factor model purports to be an example of that. This all arose because the CAPM, which was the original model in which there was only one risk factor, the market beta, we loved that model for about 20 years, and then we up and decided, wait a minute, this thing has never worked. So we went on from there to these multi-factor models, and that's basically what Ken and I have been doing for the last 20 years. Lots of the academic literature focuses on that kind of model, and I think the investment business has really gone in that direction. So value investing, all of that dimensional investing is basically different dimensions of risk that potentially have different prices per unit of risk. Now, why? That's a different story. They have much less success telling stories about why there are different dimensions of risk that are priced differently. All we know is they seem to be there over long periods of time and across many markets.
So are you all at all concerned? I mean, is your own thinking has evolved? You've gone from, you know, three-factor model to now drafting a paper on a five-factor model. We're seeing this proliferation of factors or quasi-factors. Are you concerned that you know, some of these may be sort of less well vetted? There's less empirical data. It's just not as strong.
No, that's always a concern. Another one of my students is writing a paper trying to enumerate the possible number of factors, and I think he quit at 150.
That's a big model.
Right, but the five-factor model that we developed is basically just an extension of the three-factor model. So the three-factor model kind of focuses on the book-to-market ratio. But we've long known that that's not a pure measure of expected return, that the market price reflects the discount rate that goes into the pricing of cash flows, but it also reflects the cash flows. So basically what the five-factor model does is it tries to control for the cash flows so that you get a more precise story about the expected return. Now, having said that, we have another paper in which what we show is that once you get beyond two dimensions of expected returns, the third adds very little, no matter how you start. I mean, it doesn't matter where you start. So if you start with size and value, say, and you add profitability, you don't get much. If you start with profitability and value, size doesn't get much. The problem is that these things tend to be correlated. So, for example, momentum and value. Well, value stocks tend to be negative momentum stocks. So if you want to get momentum, you're going to have to give up a lot of value to do it. And that's the general thing that happens when you try to combine these things. To get more of something, you have to give up some of the other stuff that you're focusing on. So two is about the number that you have to take into account.
What about some of the factors that we've seen emerge outside of sort of the context of your work? So we see things now like quality, is there a low volatility premium? What are your thoughts on those?
I can explain all of those with the five-factor model, frankly. They're just manifestations of this. We have another paper on that coming out. So these.
How do you have time to be here, Gene?
Ken works very hard. We have the mechanics that do all of this stuff. So we have people who assemble the data for us, and then we just think about what we want to do and process it. But I lost the train of thought there. So what was the question?
So something like quality or low volatility, you're saying quality, some of the five factors.
Quality, you'd be talking about a tilt towards profitable firms that don't invest a lot. And the five-factor model said, yeah, they will do better given their book-to-market ratios. But you have to control for all three of these things. So I can explain why the relation between average return and beta is flat. The low beta stocks tend to be profitable stocks that don't invest very much, have a slight tilt towards value. The high beta stocks tend to be growth stocks, a lot of small growth stocks in there that are unprofitable and invest like crazy. And there's one group that appears everywhere in every sort, it's given a different name, but it's the same group of stocks. They're small unprofitable growth stocks that invest a lot. No matter which sort you do, if they pop up in a portfolio, your asset pricing model just grinds to a halt. You cannot explain why their returns are so low. And that turns up in lots of these so-called smart beta sorts. I'm afraid to fall asleep anymore because I know when I wake up in the morning, there'll be a new jingo in the investment community that I have to learn, whether it's smart beta that turns out to be old beta, the same old stuff in a different name. But it's the current marketing words, I think, is what it comes down to. But all of these things are... Beta has always been just the market beta, as far as... And all the other stuff is not really about beta. But anyway.
So we want to go back to the active-passive and ask you a question about everyone's favorite, perhaps the most successful active manager of all time, Warren Buffett. Is that luck? Is that skill? Is that risk? How do you explain
that's a good
Warren
question.
Buffett's success?
So I would like to do the same thing we did for mutual funds with CEOs and see if you can distinguish luck from skill among the population of CEOs. Now, the population of CEOs is way bigger than the population of money managers, so the range of outcomes that you can get by chance is enormous. And the guys who are really successful are going to get anointed, and the guys that fail are going to be, you know, qualified as dumb. But maybe it's just lucky versus unlucky. But if you I'm not saying that's true in his case. This test is just too hard to do. I'd love to do it, but it's too hard to do. But I think he's like my hero, because what he says is, I can pick a company every couple of years, but if you have to form a portfolio, you're better off going passive.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kahneman says that, all the behavioral people say the same thing. It's, in the end, they realize that the game of doing something active is fraught with losses.
Double checking to make sure Joe wasn't running back to the office. So I've got a question for you. You know, all this said, what do you personally invest in? Is that out of bounds?
No, I've always just held market portfolios, basically. Now I'm getting older, so in my retirement stuff, I've got tips. I bought the tips when they were a lot more attractive than they are now, but. Since that's high tax stuff, I put that in the retirement account, and the rest is basically index portfolios. I have a big exposure to value because I've been involved with Dimensional since they started, and that's a very valuable asset, actually. But
so the last question I want to ask before we open it up to the broader group. You know, what was your Nobel experience like? I mean, I imagine it's not like, you know, Publishers Clearing House where Ed McMahon and a crew with a bunch of balloons and a camera show up and hand you an award.
Well,
like,
I'll tell you.
How did you find out? Like, what
well,
was the highlight
for you? There is a date that you know they're going to announce them. I had been mentioned for like 25 years as a potential candidate, but the probability that you're going to get it at any time is very low because there are a lot of people who could get it. So I was preparing my class. I had a class at 9 o'clock that morning, and I do exercises in the morning for my back, and I was finishing those, and I listen to opera while I'm doing that, and I like it turned way up. So this thing is blaring away, and I answered the phone, and they said, well, will you accept it? And I said, what do you think? But and then I went into my wife. She had her door closed into our bedroom. And the phone in there, she has the sound turned off because she wants to try to sleep. And I said, well, we're going to Sweden. And she said, for what? And I said, to get the Nobel Prize. And she said, no. And I said, yes, no, yes, no, yes. And finally she started to cry, so then she accepted it, I guess. But then it was 5 minutes later that the press was at the door. Five minutes later. And they wanted to come to my class. I said, man, no, these kids are paying a lot of money. Nobody comes to my class unless you have a ticket. So I did my class, and then the university did a big thing in the Harper Center where the walls were just full of people. I mean, there were thousands of people there and all of the media people. And the only time there was a bigger crowd was when David Booth gave us $300 million. That attracted a lot of people. But then after that is when it gets hectic, because all of a sudden, before that, you were just another dumb guy. And all of a sudden, now everybody wants a piece, you know? And you could spend your life traveling around the world if you wanted to, charging exorbitant fees. I decided right away that I liked my life the way it was. I liked what I was doing. I wasn't going to do anything differently. But the real experience is when you go there. They give you a slave. two slaves, actually. So that you get a car, the biggest BMW I ever saw, has a big Nobel insignia on the side of it. And you have a driver who's at your disposal 24 hours a day. And this is the biggest event in Sweden. So when that car comes along, the police stop the traffic. And you go through like it was, I don't know, Rahm Emanuel or somebody. They stop the traffic. And you can drive up on the sidewalk. You can go down one-way streets. It doesn't matter. But the other one you have, the other person you have is from the Foreign Service, a high-level person who keeps your itinerary. And the reason you need this person is because you ever looked at it, you'd kill yourself. They have you giving literally 10 talks a day, traveling all over the place, going to high schools even to talk to kids. It's a hectic experience. My wife and kids and grandkids, I brought 20 people over there for it. They had a great time, but I never got to see anything. But then the ceremony is totally impressive. It's in the orchestra hall, and the king and the queen. And you cannot come into the place unless you have tails on. And you do this, you know, great ceremony. And then afterward, you go to a dinner, small dinner, sit-down dinner, for 1,200 people in this huge hall where it's an ancient place. It has like little openings, and they're running like an opera while the dinner is going on. There are different forms of entertainment, live entertainment going on. They're coming among the crowd and everything. And then the next night, you go for an intimate dinner at the king's house. There are only 600 people there. So my wife, who's like, I would say she's conservative, but that would be not really stating that. She's sitting next to the Prime Minister of Sweden, talking to him about politics. But she had a great time. I did too, actually.
Well, that's great. I think we have now time maybe for, I'm just checking time real quick, bear with me, we've got about 10 minutes, so time for a handful of questions from the audience. We've got people with microphones, so please just raise your hand. We'll take the first question from the gentleman up at the front here.
Yeah, if I could go back to risk for a minute.
Okay.
I fully appreciate the fact that most of the money managers don't do as well as the index, and it certainly makes sense if passive investment works. But I've never seen anything you put out that talks about tactical management of risk, so that when the benchmark is clearly drunk and you don't want to follow it because it's going to bad places, that you can avoid losing money during those periods.
You're talking about market timing. I don't think there's any evidence that that works either. But
I'm not talking about market timing. I'm talking about risk evaluation and getting out of the way when you're going through a 07 through 09 crisis, or when you're going through a Greek crisis.
If you sold when the market crashed, you made a big mistake. If you saw it coming, you're a genius.
But no, I think actually you could see it coming while watching the risk profile change.
Okay.
You don't believe in the risk allocation?
No, I don't.
All right.
I believe in the, I know the words exist. I don't think there's any evidence that says it works. But
I'm having difficulty seeing, so do we have any other questions out there? Is I one over here, okay. Should have brought my sunglasses up here.
I think you said the market portfolio is what you invest in now?
Yep.
The investable universe has changed dramatically since you started your analysis. There's more computational power. How do you even define the market portfolio?
It's just the cap-weighted portfolio of all of the traded stocks.
But that's just stocks. There's real estate.
Right,
there's bond markets.
Right. I don't do that. I don't fool around with bonds. Look at the profile. I'm a tenured professor, right? The university issued me a bond. So that's I've been holding a bond. That's been my major investment for most of my lifetime. And accumulated wealth, I'm not spending it anyway, so might as well just leave it in the market. Some charities are going to get it eventually.
We've got another question towards the back there.
So you talked about the factor investing versus cap-weighted. Do you have a strong preference to either one? Because it seems like...
So the factor invest, if you want to tilt towards one of the dimensions of risk that we think are out there, that's fine, but you do it in a cap-weighted way, I think. The advantage of doing things in a cap-weighted way is that cap-weighted portfolios are self-balancing. You don't have to... I mean, there, things go in and out. To that extent, they're not self-balancing. But the weights change with prices, so you don't have to actually do any trading to keep them, to keep whatever you want to hold in the right proportions. Whereas if you do something fancier or different than that, you're going to do more trading. And I always contend that whatever exposures to risk factors you can get by not cap weighting, I can get them with cap weights.
Nice.
Any other questions out there? I think we have one up here.
Hi, Professor Fama. It's a pleasure and an honor to talk to you. When you go through the analyses and you're doing your testing, what percent of the data set on average actually does beat indexing?
Oh, if I give them their indexing, okay. No, if they give them their cost, now if I give them their costs back and I look at everything before costs, it's 50%. But that's exactly what you'd expect by chance. So now in the tails before costs, there are a small fraction in the right tail and a small fraction in the left tail that are too extreme relative to what you'd expect by chance. So there's evidence of skill in the population, good and bad skill. Now that's important, because going back to the arithmetic of active management, if there's good skill, it has to be bad skill, because one eats the other. So you see that. Now, as I said, the problem, though, is out in the right tail, there are also, even in the most extreme parts of it, funds that are there by chance. And you cannot tell luck from skill. That's the whole problem. You can't tell good luck from good skill. You can't tell bad luck from bad skill. So that's kind of the real challenge to it. And it's the problem really goes back to the fact that stock returns are so volatile, especially if you're talking about an undiversified, actively managed portfolio. It's going to have such high volatility that makes it even much more difficult to tell luck from skill. So it's all, if you give me a total market portfolio indexed, well, that's going to be correlated with the total market, 9999. So I can estimate the effect of costs and all of that stuff quite reliably. But if you give me an actively managed portfolio, the R squared that I'm going to get from my model is going to be much, much lower. And there's a lot more in there that's due to chance. That has to be true. Otherwise, they're just closet indexers.
We have time, I think, for two more questions.
Yeah.
Sure. You mentioned that however you slice the risk factors and things like that, there's a certain segment of stocks, the small,
right,
heavy investing, unprofitable stocks that probably...
Tiny ones
that can maybe explain the low beta and the low volatility.
Well, not entirely. See, I need a little... The low beta, they don't pop up in that one. That one I can explain entirely.
The high beta,
right,
the opposite of the high beta.
Right.
So do you would you recommend eliminating them entirely, Or do you think it's always best to just sort of underweight or try to tilt away from these risk factors?
Well, if you're talking about their weight in the market portfolio is trivial. These are tiny growth stocks. I don't even think they approach anything like 1% of the market.
So are there any segments of the market that you think would make sense for regular investors to eliminate entirely? Or should they? Or do you think if they want to take extra risk, then they can just tilt away from them?
Well, you know, those are decisions people make. To an economist, there's no such thing as bad tastes. Your tastes are what they are. If you like to tilt away or towards things, you can look at all the research that I've ever done and say, I like big growth stocks. I can't argue with that. As long as you buy a diversified portfolio of big growth stocks. You can look at everything you see on stocks and value and all of that and say, I don't like any of that volatility. Give me T-bills. That's an efficient portfolio. I can't argue with that. So my answer is I don't have an answer to your question.
And one last question.
The general answer is you pick your risk exposures and then you diversify the hell out of it. And that's the best you can do.
I was just hoping that you could give us a little color on the dynamic that you enjoyed with your co-winners in Sweden and since.
Well, I haven't seen Bob since then. The dynamic is, he and I agree on the evidence. We disagree on the interpretation. So he sees all kinds of things floating around that explain the behavior of why volatility is so high and things like that. But there's nothing that you can actually test. And I just kept slamming him on that. Tell me how to test what you're saying. And he kept talking about psychology and all of that. And he said he got that from his wife, who was a psychologist. And I said, why are you always blaming for your wife for your bad ideas? But he's a very talented fellow. The other one, Lars Hansen is, I mean, Lars is, I can't even read his stuff. It's so complicated. But he is really primo in the area of... See, what's happened over time is that macroeconomics and finance have kind of merged to a large extent. So there are a lot of people like Lars and John Cochran and other people who kind of jump back and forth between those two. They introduce finance to macro people and they introduce finance people to macro, and they work across those two areas. So Lars is kind of the prime person in that area. He's a monumental fellow. I mean, he's incredible. University of Chicago was... I can tell you a story. So this was like the day after the announcement of the Nobel Prize. So the Nobel Prize people came over and they wanted to do like a little snippet. So you know, I don't know if you know the Harper Center, but there's a big garden on the first floor. It's not a garden. It's actually a congregation area for students. And the students are sitting around there. They're reading and they're eating lunch, working together on their homeworks and everything. So the guy says, can we walk across here so I can film you while we're walking across? And so I said, sure. So we walk across and we get to the other side and he turns to me and he said, nobody looked up. And I said, if they had to look up every time somebody from Chicago got a Nobel Prize, that's all they'd be doing.
Well, Gene, I can't thank you enough for having been here. It's really an honor, and thank you all for your terrific questions.